Hello and welcome to the IMD Podcast Network. This week, the start of a new series of podcasts on sustainability, headed up by IMD professors Julia Binder and Knut Harness.
The energy transition isn't coming. It's already here. From boardrooms to trading floors, from tech labs to oil rigs, the shift toward clean energy is reshaping how business gets done. Welcome to Inside the Transition, a new podcast series from IMD. I'm Julia Binder.
And I'm Knut Harness. Together, Julia and I will bring you conversations with the people at the front line of this historic shift of the energy transition. You'll hear from top executives at the energy companies and industrial firms. You'll hear from climate tech pioneers and innovators, and from the analysts and the investors watching the data, the markets, and the decisions that shape our future.
We will go behind closed doors to understand how business leaders are navigating risks and spotting opportunities in the energy transition. Real conversations about how the transition is unfolding in practice. With us today is Paul Watkinson, an energy and climate policy expert and a consultant with more than 20 years' experience in international climate negotiations. With a few weeks before the COP30 in Brazil, we are going to discuss what's going on with the energy transition, whether current discussions on sustainability have driven us into a dead end, and what business leaders should expect in a more divided and conflictual world. Paul, thank you so much for joining Inside the Transition.
Thank you. I'm delighted to join you.
Thank you for being with us. And you have such a long experience in this climate negotiation space, which has been so important. Now we're at a little bit of a special moment. And could you share with us a little bit how you read the times we're in? What's going on in this big climate negotiation area?
Well, thank you so much. And I think it's good to start with a very big question. I'll try and give you a short answer that at least gets some of the key points. I've been part of the multilateral effort to put in place a response to climate change for a quarter of a century. Since 2000, I think, was the first time I went in person to a COP, and I've been following it even longer. I think a large part of our effort for many years was developing a treaty, developing a legal framework to govern where countries were acting, but also to start to build in spaces where we could associate other actors, including business, cities, and so forth. Now, then we achieved that very largely in Paris 10 years ago by adopting the Paris Agreement. And we've spent much of the past 10 years making sure we can put it into force, developing all the detailed rules around it. And we're in the process now of getting parties to put forward new targets. We call them nationally determined contributions, or NDCs, where they say the mitigation targets, what they're going to do to reduce and manage their greenhouse gas emissions by 2035, and the policies that they're going to implement to go along with that. Now then, this has moved from the space of the traditional multilateral negotiation between governments to be much more a space around how do we overcome barriers to action? How do we create the right conditions for higher ambition to put us on the pathway to a deep transition of our energy systems, also our urban infrastructure and our food systems, I would add as well, which need to be addressed. Now, of course, it's not as easy as that. The politics of this are also getting extremely complicated. We're starting to deal with not just small, marginal changes. We're starting to talk about how we make the deep fundamental changes to our energy systems, but also, as I said, to other infrastructure and systems. They're much harder questions. So it's not surprising that we're starting to get political challenges to that. Clearly, the biggest challenge today is with the United States, which under President Trump has moved into outright opposition to climate policy. But in all countries, we see that in the European Union at the moment, there's hesitation about how fast and how far we move forward. So all of that is playing into this multilateral space. I think the big challenge now is to move from a traditional focus on let's negotiate the deal, the rules, the guidelines, and the overall collective targets, to ones about how we overcome the barriers, including what are increasingly internal political barriers, social challenges, mobilizing the finance, making the transition work, and making it acceptable, building public support for it.
Paul, that is super interesting. And I think maybe a couple of points where we want to dive a little bit deeper is you've mentioned that there is obviously this big political agenda at the moment that is not very conducive of our climate targets. And at the same time, you're saying we're basically moving now from we have targets, how do we implement them? And I'm wondering, from your perspective, where are we in the energy transition, right? What have we achieved? If you could take stock, despite the, let's say, negotiations, where are we in the energy transition? Where do we stand? How positive or negative should we be?
We've certainly moved, from a situation where back in the early 2000s, the idea of having large-scale use of renewables was just not possible. It wasn't something which was achievable at that time. If you look at the cost curves for wind power, for onshore, offshore, and of course for photovoltaic, but also batteries, electric vehicles, those costs have come down dramatically over the past decade and a half now. It's that change in the fundamental economics which made a huge difference. The challenge now is to move to scale, at which point, of course, you run into practical challenges. How do you ensure that your grid operates in when you need a large amount of storage and you need to keep the stability of the grid in changing conditions? How do you manage the social transition as you have to move work, retrain the workforce in some of the traditional energy sectors as we move into new opportunities, but it's not for the same people? These are the challenges which are more and more in the forefront. So I think we've gone a long way down that road. We've shown that it's possible. We brought it to a situation where we can take it much, much further. We've also seen, and I'll finish on this, I think, you know, Europe obviously has moved a long way down this road. It's still got a long way to go. But China in particular is positioning itself very much at the forefront of the key industries for transformation. It's still investing in the fossil fuel economy. It's creating the conditions which are needed to transition to a non-fossil fuel economy. So I think we're in this world. The big challenge is for much of the rest of the world. I mean, the investment which is not going to most developing countries outside China and a few others. Much of the world is not getting anything like the investment it needs to manage that transition. So it's a very uneven transition. As I said, it's building pushback at the moment. So it's reaching a critical stage, essentially.
So the world's attention is now moving to Brazil. There's the new global climate negotiations going to take place there in just a few weeks. It's number 30, 30 in a row. We had the Paris Agreement. You were part of that, Paul, and I think it was really a breakthrough in so many ways. But how do you see these whole negotiations going forward? Do you see that as a necessary part of the infrastructure? Is it the solution? Is it something that will have to change? How do you see that, the global getting together around climate?
I mean, it's easy to criticize the climate conferences, the COPs. The last few COPs have attracted almost 100,000 people in Dubai 2 years ago. It's easy to show this as a sort of traveling circus with so many people turning up, spending so much money. But I think the first thing is that people now want to be there. I think that says something about the importance of these events, that so many people find it valuable. And most of them are not going for the traditional negotiations. They're going because we've been developing what we've called the action agenda, which is a space alongside the traditional formal negotiations between governments, which is associating much more governments, yes, international organizations, but increasingly business, subnational, civil society, in initiatives to take the forward ways of overcoming the challenges in different sectors, different industries, different specific issues we need to address. So the process has been shifting. We still need a forum. It's like a global parliament to oversee where we're going collectively. And every 5 years, we have a global stocktake. We did it 2 years ago, where we look at collective progress. Of course, it's not enough. We need to strengthen that. And we set out a number of challenges we should try and meet collectively by 2030, including tripling renewables, doubling energy efficiency, ending deforestation, and transitioning away from fossil fuels. So we've been giving guidance on where we go. It's also not only about energy and mitigation. It's also about climate impacts. It's also about working with the most vulnerable. And I think that's one of the key reasons we need to keep a UN universal format here, because it allows the smallest, weakest countries to also have their say. But as I say, increasingly, the COP is about this wider space. And one of the key challenges for Belém in Brazil in a few weeks' time is moving from let's do lots of things, which has been the tendency of the last few years here, launching multiple initiatives on multiple themes. They're great. The COP president, the minister who's in charge of the event, gets to be in the middle of a photo with some presidents, CEOs, preferably a film star or something as well. It looks great, but it needs follow-up. And a lot of these have not had the follow-up they need to deliver. The Brazilians are trying to structure it around the key challenges that we identified 2 years ago in the global stocktake. And I think if they can do that and above all take it forward, it's a real complement to the traditional multilateral role, but it's one about really delivering and taking forward collective action, not just between governments, and it doesn't need everyone to be on board for this. It's also with business, with cities, with other actors who can really make a difference. And that's where it will increasingly be.
Paul, you mentioned before the important role of China, and this is something that Knut and myself, we have been working on this, where we basically looked into, it used to be a hidden champion. I think it's not so hidden anymore. We see a clear climate leadership in these technologies as well. And yet at the same time, obviously, China's role and China's leadership in that also creates new dependencies on technology, on supply chains, on critical minerals. We actually just saw that China is reducing again the export of these rare earths, for instance. And I'm just wondering, what role should Europe play in this new energy order? And what should our long-term vision really be? Because do we have a long-term vision? And if so, where do we want to play in this new world order?
I think that's a really central question for debate and for particularly for Europe to see what it needs as it moves forward. And I'm worried at the moment because I see an internal debate happening in Europe. We put in place over the past 5 years the Green Deal at a European level, setting out clear targets for our long-term decarbonization, the transition of key sectors such as the automobile industry, and of course, our energy systems. And we're seeing question marks as to the speed we're going at and the way in which we implement those policies. Now then, it is normal and right to see whether things are working. And sometimes it's a good thing to say, well, let's take a year or two and let's adjust some of these things. We were a bit too heavy-handed. Those things, that's normal common sense. But we're starting to question some of the direction. And I think that's sending the wrong signal, particularly when China has been investing so heavily over the past decade in putting its industrial infrastructure in place. So it's about how we really ensure that we have a serious industrial policy going forward, a term which has been sort of taboo for so many years, but which is now essential in this field. And I think one of the key challenges is how can we align that? I don't think we can coordinate, but how can we align it with the policies elsewhere? Now, obviously, the US under President Trump is basically tearing up the script and into defending the traditional fossil fuel industries. But you know, the question is, how can we protect where we need the new industries or the industries which are making the transition? Things like the carbon border adjustment mechanism become particularly important in a place like that to ensure that we do not simply lose out from that transition. But how do we coordinate ourselves, you know, align ourselves with others, in particular with China, where we have both competition and cooperation? And I think how we manage that is going to be critical. For the moment, we're going more for competition and we're not winning. So I think we need some balance to come into there. And maybe it's by thinking about how we collaborate, working with some of the other countries in the world, particularly in the developing world, where there can be a win-win for Europe and China working together as we take this transition forward.
And Paul, I think we were here talking about something so interesting and fundamentally important as well. It feels to me like the long-term vision is not that complicated in a way, because we know that we will have to build a new energy system. It's just a question of how long it takes. We know that we have to link it to competitiveness. We know that we have to find growth because we have to make all these investments and we have to take care of, and that's what you work on a lot, Julia. We have to take care of the materials and the metals and the minerals we have, right? So we have to find circular solutions. That's kind of a vision. What's holding us back, Paul? Why aren't we kind of just taking the steps in almost like a simple direction?
I sometimes made the joke that if we had a benevolent global dictator, the world would be so much easier. We could sort of plan things in a rational way. We don't. And thankfully, we don't, because I think it would actually would be far from benevolent. And I certainly don't want us to find ourselves there. But we don't have that way of planning things, even in our own countries as democracies. This planning is difficult. And I think we are reaching the time when we're not making the little changes that go unnoticed. We're making deep changes. Those are complicated. And so it's normal that people hesitate. I think it's normal that we say, how do we, you know, maybe if we took another 5 years, we'll just keep doing what we know we're doing well. But if we're not projecting ourselves beyond the short term, this tragedy of the horizon problem, which keeps on coming up in this area, if we're not projecting ourselves beyond the 5 or even 10 years ahead and really thinking, where do we need to be by the middle of the century? And as you say, where we're going, the vision is quite simple. The connection between that and our short-term, medium-term actions, that's where we're failing. I think that's where the big challenge is at a multilateral level as well. The nationally determined contributions, we're now looking at to 2030, 2035, but we need to be thinking, are they really aligned with pathways to net zero by the middle of the century? And that's where we're missing. They're not at the moment. And even the new NDCs that are coming forward, they're only starting to be aligned with that deeper transition. So we're still not developing, you know, fully. And I think it's just very difficult for us all. It's very difficult for anybody to say, you know, but in 25 years' time, where are we? Well, I'm not in charge by then. I'll be moved on to another post, or I'll be retired, or maybe I won't be here at all. It's very easy to pass the buck. So I think all of these things come together to make it difficult.
And now we're talking deep inside the transition, Paul, as we were aspiring to. And my question is, a lot of the criticism that Europe got was that in many ways we try to regulate ourselves out of this, right? So we're trying to create a lot of regulatory pressure rather than incentives, whereby China is much more on the how can we actually incentivize business to go in that direction. And I'm wondering, on your perspective, how do we get the balance right from more regulatory push and restrictions towards how do we really create the conditions for businesses to be successful and actually take a share from this? And maybe where do you also see Europe taking a leading innovation role when it comes to the climate transition?
I'm probably not the best person to answer all of those questions, because I'm coming from a more generalist multilateral point of view. But I certainly think that we need to, as you said, have a clearer sense of truly how we see ourselves in the future. And then to focus on how we can we actually, you know, as I said earlier, we've been refusing to talk about industrial policy for many years. And it's difficult to suddenly move to a situation where we have to. We have to have something, whether we call it an industrial policy, whether we call it a Green Deal, a green competitive deal. We have to think about what that means. That needs to create the incentives for business as we move forward. It needs to have support for our research programs to take that forward over time. And it needs collaboration at a multilateral level. Some of these areas, we need to understand we're not going to achieve it all on our own. We will want to have winners, but we will also want to collaborate with some of our partners. And sometimes that will be companies in the US. Sometimes it will be companies in China, sometimes in India or wherever else. We need to work at these different levels. So I can't give you a great answer to that. I think you've got a better answer than I have. But I see it in those terms. We need to think now how these policies fit together to create the right balance. And as you say, it's not just regulation. Of course, we need standards, but we need more than that for this truly to move forward.
And Julia, I just want to jump in on your question, because I really like the question. And it just strikes me when I think about it and I listen to you, Paul. Regulation, it feels like it has no costs, but it actually has very high hidden costs when you have to reverse, when you have to go back on things, etc. Incentives, you call them incentives, Judah, they're a little bit different. They have high initial costs because they're big investments up front. But if you make the investments in areas that are attractive, they actually pay off in the longer term. And I think, you know, listening to you and thinking about the journey of the COPs and the international negotiations, it feels to me like there has been a lot of focus on collaboration, a lot of focus on regulation. Now we're maybe at the time when we are more rivalry and competition, and where we have to look at the investments, not only the regulation. So it feels to me we're in a little bit of an inflection point when it comes to how this is going to change, how we should put focus, etc., which maybe that's negative, but in some ways there are opportunities there as well. I don't know. What do you think, Julia?
For me, this is actually it's one of the biggest playing fields for businesses when you are now looking for what are the future market opportunities. And I think this is where China in many ways has shown that this can actually be very profitable. And how do we actually see this not just as a risk to mitigate, but as an opportunity to pursue? And I think it's a different mindset. And in many ways, I think this is one that could be very beneficial, is instead of always trying to say, okay, we should do that, to say, what could we actually get out by pursuing these opportunities? And we already see that there are massive market opportunities. So I think, and maybe that is the question for you, Paul, and then to bring it full circle back to you, is that maybe this is what we're seeing at the COP, where basically now business leaders make a very important part of the people around the table, which wasn't the case a couple of years ago, where this was clearly focused around political leaders. Now business leaders are a part of these negotiations, actually in many ways oftentimes outnumber the politicians there.
I think that's what is happening, but with a slight nuance to that. The question of, you know, fixing norms, regulation, there's still a tendency in the multilateral talks to think about how can we decide the pathway? How can we decide how to phase out fossil fuels is the big question which keeps on coming up. And of course, we need very clear signals about where we're heading. But it's clear that even at a national level, it's very hard to develop a detailed timetable around that. At an international level, it's just not possible. But by sending a clear signal that we're going this way, we can then talk about how we are collaborating around it and how different actors coming into the process are contributing to that. And I think that's where we're shifting to. You said, I think, Knut, you suggested we've already moved a lot towards collaboration. I'd say we're doing some collaboration in this space, but we haven't structured it well enough. And I think as we move forward, it's about having the right platforms for collaboration, which don't need to be negotiated by 200 countries and agreed by consensus. They can move forward in the sectors which matter with the people around the table who are working on it. If we're dealing with methane from energy systems, if we're dealing with transition in short-lived gases, if we're talking about a number of very specific targets, we can bring the right people together in multiple fora. What we need is a sense this is collectively moving forward, in a space we see what's happening and which can then give overall guidance about it. That's what the COP can do. As I said, it's an overall governance of the process, but it needs a broader set of processes moving forward. And increasingly, there's going to be the business community coming in with solutions, taking in the opportunities and then explaining how that's being used. I think the challenge is if at a national level, that's where the regulation comes in, that's holding it back. And for some reason, we've got regulations which are counterproductive. How do we adjust those? And I think that message, ultimately, it has to come down to a national level, because at a multilateral level, all we can really do is talk about the overall direction and facilitate that collaboration. The detail of it has then to be managed nationally.
Paul, you've said many times that the energy transition has to be just. I've mentioned it also in this recording now, that people need to feel it works for them, not against them. And in France, the Yellow Vest protests showed what happens when climate policies ignore social fairness and social realities, in a sense. So from your perspective, how do we manage to align the two? Because you already mentioned we need to align workforce, but there are so many more implications when we talk about this just transition. How do we get people on board of this agenda?
I wish I had a great answer to that, because it's one of the biggest challenges we face. But I think there are several things which can help us. The first one is listening to people, associating them, engaging them. I mean, in France, we did have the Citizens' Convention on Climate a few years ago, bringing 100 people together. I think in the end, that proved to be too complicated, because it was trying to deal with everything. And it came up with a wonderful plan, which then got pulled to pieces and left a lot of people rather unhappy who'd been part of it. But I think the principle behind it was good, because how do you involve people in setting the policies that affect their lives? And I think one of the challenges from the Gilets Jaunes, the Yellow Vest movement, was a sense that decisions were being taken to increase the cost of fuel, or to remove tax, to remove subsidies, essentially, to increase the cost of fuel, which left them seriously out of pocket. And for people whose lives were already struggling, the basic cost of transport and so forth were really sensitive. And it had a sense of people not being listened to. So I think the first one is, how do you associate people to ensure that they understand what we're doing and that the tools we do help them? The second is, how can we really take just transition from being a phrase to being something which is seriously implemented? That's about developing skills, particularly for industry as it's looking forward. What are the skills that are needed, that the workforce needs to be trained for? That's a shared responsibility between business, governments, and local governments to work together on that. How do we ensure that the transition, at times, it's going to affect some areas much more than others. It can be very localized in its impact. That creates huge challenges for the managing of it and keeping the public support. That needs public policies to accompany that change. So it's ensuring that these are properly thought through and carried through. And one of the big challenges we unfortunately have is we very rarely provide the resources which are needed to manage that. We see it in access support for low carbon or electric vehicles for the poorest. These tools unfortunately run out of money very, very quickly. Funding for renovation of buildings, that tends to run out very quickly. So the resources which are really needed for this, unfortunately, need to be greater. That's a difficult political equation to manage because we're also running, our budgets are tight at a national level. But the transition does have a cost. And if we're not also thinking about how we fund that cost. So I think associating people and ensuring we have the tools to accompany it so that people see that their lives are better, rather than being told, this is what the science says, this is what a multilateral organization says. Well, yeah, but it's my life. You need to give people the opportunity to see why it's their future, which is there. And I think it's the same with business, these small businesses, which need to be associated to take the opportunity, to seize that opportunity to bring the solutions that we need.
And Paul, it's really interesting to listen to you. And one reflection or one question that came up in my mind listening now to your discussion about the Yellow West, as you asked, Julia, is how do we frame this? Because at the risk of being too simplistic, I think we can say climate has very much been a game of playing not to lose. A threat, a risk, a doomsday in many ways. And I mean, we've all been part of that and it's real. No doubt. We see the challenge and the crisis. So the question is whether, framing-wise, there's a need also to, and you allude to that, to make it about playing to win. Make it about the opportunity here, the society we can create, the way this can lead us to growth, solve some of the social problems we have, etc. I don't know how you see that, Paul. Have we been a little bit too much on the play not to lose? Is there an opportunity to frame it more as kind of playing to win? Or is that too naive in a situation which is definitely a grave one when it comes to climate?
No, I think you're very much on the right lines there. I think for many years, people felt it was sort of the catastrophes are a good thing. I say that in inverted commas, the big climate impacts brought people's minds to bear to realize the seriousness of the challenge. Therefore, people will want to act. And it does work a bit along those lines. But that's not the way forward, because it's not creating any sense of hope or vision of what we're doing. It can even create despair that we're incapable of stopping this and we're going to lose. We're all going to die, sort of, which you hear from some people with this sort of climate catastrophism. I don't think that helps at all. Yes, the situation is serious. We need to be very frank about the changes which are going on. It was more than 1.5 degrees warmer last year than it is in pre-industrial times. And unfortunately, we're still heading in that direction. But the ability to build a low carbon future, a resilient future, is real. It comes back to the question earlier about the changes, the energy transition moving forward. It's the same if I think about the urban environment. We can build cities, we can make our cities more livable, which is also very important for the resilience to the climate impacts. So it's much more about building this constructive, more positive way of seeing the future, that we have to turn it into an opportunity for transformation, an opportunity also for business. It's an opportunity to deliver in the future. And I think that's much more positive. I think that's much more mobilizing than simply saying, it's dreadful, we must do this because otherwise the world will end. The world's not going to end, but it can be very nasty unless we make some of the changes that we can do. And it's creating the, coming back to the word incentives, which has come up several times, it's creating the right incentives in our system to make those changes. And sometimes we've been too much in the top-down regulation and not enough in the creating the conditions for change.
And I loved the positive twist to it, Paul. And I think maybe that's also a good way to end our conversation today. And it's on this positive note, because I think you're talking about hope and vision. And in many ways, this has been lacking oftentimes, as Knut also said, in the conversation around climate. It was often, how do we prevent the worst from happening, rather than what is it that we want to create? What is it that we want to achieve? One of the methods that Knut and I like to use in our classes is called Future Back, whereby basically we want to envision, rather than saying, okay, forecasting, this is how the future will unfold, we say, create a vision of this is how a desirable future looks like. So I would like you, Paul, to maybe end on that note and say, imagine it's 2040. We managed to basically get on this positive pathway. We peaked emissions. We're all better off. We see that we're finally really getting this right. All the negotiations finally playing off. And I would love to hear from you, what are the top things that got us there? How did we master? How did we kind of turn the ship around? What got us on this positive path?
I got to give an answer to this. This is the hardest question you've given me. I think it's the determination, first of all. It's the recognition that the vision we have of a low carbon future is achievable. It's not taking our time revisiting and, you know, working backwards in the wrong way. So it's looking forwards. It's embracing the change which is in front of us. It's also very much what we were talking about a moment ago, the integration of people, the integration of the just transition. Because I think without that, this is going to keep on hitting barriers of public acceptability. And that creates the opportunity for those who want to push back to do so. Of course, there are those who see themselves as losers out of this. Some of the businesses will go out of business. That's normal. That's normal sort of constructive destruction as we move forward. There will be many who will gain from this. And I think it's giving the voices of those who are going to gain from it and who see the opportunity, giving them as much weight, more weight, than those who want to hold us back and to say, let's slow things down. So I think it's not an individual policy. I think we've got the policy frameworks. We know most of the technologies we need. Of course, we still need some big research programs around decarbonizing some heavy industry, steel, cement. We know roughly what we can do, but there's still more to be done in those fields. Buildings, agriculture is going to be particularly difficult to succeed. But these things are achievable. But it's building with people, it's building the vision of where we're going and sticking with it. And it's also giving weight to the voices of those who seize the opportunity over those who want to slow us down. And there will always be some who want to slow us down and say, well, no, let's just keep where we are. But if we got the political sense of movement and managing the barriers, overcoming the barriers, the final point I'd say, this cannot be something just for Europe, just for the North. It has to be an inclusive transformation for the world, and in particular, our partners in developing countries. This cannot be about creating even wider divides between, say, Europe and Africa. There needs to be solutions, particularly for, there will be 2 billion people in Africa by the middle of this century. There's a huge need, there's a huge opportunity for Africa as a huge market, a source of raw materials, but also a driver of solutions as well and a key partner for Europe. So Europe seeing its partners, Asia, Africa, and of course the Americas, but a particular stress on Africa, I think, as we move forward, because the solutions need to work there as well.
So just quick follow-up to your question, Julian. Thank you for the answer, Paul. When you reflect on the question, you know, we're in 2040, we actually turned a corner on this, on the climate challenge. Does that feel like science fiction to you, Paul, or does it feel like something that can and will happen?
I think it's about determination. I think it's about making it happen. Is it easy? No, it's not easy. It's not just going to happen on its own. Some of these changes will move forward, but the range of change and the depth we need won't happen unless we really push and bring leadership to it and maintain that leadership. And I think Europe's positioned itself well in the last few years. It's hesitating at the moment. It has the ability to pursue its course. So I think it's more than science fiction. And science fiction can actually be helpful to us in this area by presenting us exactly this picture of what would the world look like in 2040 or 2050 or 2100 in a decarbonized world, in a world in which we've overcome these challenges. And it can almost be helpful. Some of the dystopias are so negative that they're not helping us. A pure utopia is too much, but a realistic vision of where the future may be is what we need in this. And I think I'd see it in those terms. Science fiction can be helpful. So sometimes it works. It won't be exactly as it is in there, but let's give ourselves that vision and let's work towards moving it, the determination.
So we should all engage in more science fiction, and the future is in our hands. Thank you so much, Paul, for being here with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Please subscribe to the Inside the Transition wherever you get your podcast and follow us. The future of energy and the future of business is already being written. Join us as we read between the lines.
That's all for this week. This podcast was proudly brought to you by the International Institute for Management Development in Lausanne. You can find out more at imd.org.